B-Pod Studios.
Gargano and Mertitus Middays.
So yesterday we talked a lot about a story which was really, really well done by Tim McManus, our own Tim McManus, of course, ESPN. The story on ESPN.com that really dove into the plight of Carson Wentz. T-Mac is with us. He's doing his podcast, which I really recommend. It's called Embedded. So check it out. But T-Mac, first of all, great job on the story, man.
Thank you. How's the shore, boys?
Shore's nice. Shore's like, it's that perfect, like, overcast. So it's a little cooler, little sea breeze. So it's perfect.
Out there. Can't be afraid of the hoodie at night, you know?
I love the hoodie at night weather.
Yeah. Yeah, me
too. That is perfect weather.
Me too. Unlike last night. They should have canceled that game in the first quarter.
Yeah. Yeah, but fortunately, God came down and said, you know what? That's enough of this.
Enough of
standard.
Please
product.
Stop.
Yeah.
Please
here's
make
a,
it
here's
stop.
Here's a lightning bolt. Go home.
Exactly. Make it stop. All right, just before we get into the story, which I thought, again, was terrific. Everybody should read it. Last night, your takeaways, let's start with the good. What did you think, what was some of your good takeaways from last night?
I thought Josh McCown coming off of retirement, he's been with the team for 5 days, you know, considering all that. He practiced 3 times, gets thrown out in there, and he didn't miss a beat. I thought that he looked really good, and it probably gives you a higher degree of confidence in the backup quarterback entering the regular season. And, of course, you know, Philadelphia fans have been spoiled by Nick Foles being that guy. It's a security blanket, Super Bowl MVP. And then there was a lot of questions this offseason. But I think even though it's, you know, it's preseason and it was a small subset, that he did show that he's a competent quarterback that can get it done. And then the guy that he was hooking up with for a good part of the night was J.J. Arcega-Whiteside. I think that, you know, the rookie has shown throughout the course of the summer that he belongs and has flashed this skill set that gets you excited, not just for the future, but I think what he can bring in certain packages this season.
Tim, who will, going into this last preseason game next week and coming out of last night in the first 3 preseason games right now, so far, needs to really show something here as kind of a last-ditch effort to try and make this 53-man roster?
Well, I think that the if you're talking about like the guys at the bottom of the roster at running back and wide receiver, to try to convince the coaches that you need to keep a fifth running back or a sixth wide receiver, guys like Greg Ward and Mark and Michelle, Wendell Smallwood at running back, along with Josh Adams, and even Boston Scott, who I like, but maybe he ends up as a practice squad candidate. And then there's a veteran or two that it would be good for them to show a little something. Stefan Wisniewski, a starter in the Super Bowl, but seems like he's getting more and more kind of lost in the shuffle a bit. So I think it would be good for him to finish training camp preseason strong, so he solidifies his spot on the roster, because they have some really good offensive line depth, and nothing's guaranteed.
What about Matt Collins?
I think he makes it. I mean, because of his value at special teams, primarily.
Yeah.
Really, when you get down to the bottom, like, who's going to be on the active game day roster and you're carrying a wide receiver? Like, Ward has shown that he has value as a receiver. I think that would carry over to the regular season. I like Greg Ward. I would try to find a way to get him on there. But I don't think it'll be in place of Hollins. I think his special team value is too great.
Ultimately, good move that Carson didn't play. I mean, everybody, they had Peters out there and Kelsey and Deshaun, but do you think it was a good move by Doug to further just bubble wrap Carson?
Well, one thing I did say is that I would be okay no matter what they did, as long as they did it in unison. If the first team was playing, then Wentz should be out there. If they're not, then they're not, and that's fine. So this was, and I have to be true to what I originally said, I mean, it was the whole first team out there with the exception of, like, you know, Sproles, essentially, and Wentz. And so I don't really love the message that sends, but I'm also not, like, you know, really, like, worked up about it, because I recognize the situation. I mean, you had quarterbacks go down over the first 2 games. You just look across at Carolina. Cam Newton goes out with a foot injury. I mean, you understand what they're doing,
listen,
right?
I saw the Cam Newton in a boot. You know, you start to go, I don't blame him.
Yeah, he walks in healthy, walks out in a boot. And for what? And so that's real. So I get it. I mean, I didn't love the message of him not being out there where the rest of the first team was, but I understand why they're doing it. And I think once we get into September, you know, these conversations have a way of just kind of melting away. It doesn't really matter whether Wentz was out there for 12 snaps or he wasn't out there for 12 snaps. But there will be possibly a conversation that, we've had, guys, of whether Wentz starts out of the gates on fire, or if there is kind of a work in progress that needs to be done as he transitions into this kind of new form of Carson Wentz. So in that respect, you know, the conversation might not be done entirely if he comes out and looks a little bit rusty.
Tim, last question for me about the roster right now going forward. Difference that you saw in Jordan Mailata from last year. I mean, he's a raw talent, as raw as they come, right?
Yeah.
Difference between last year and this year.
You know, I think he understands the game better. I think that he's still not a finished product, and we saw that there was three penalties on him, I believe, last night. And so there's still, like, and once he would get into game action, conceivably, if defenses were really messing with him, you know, would he be able to kind of pick up on everything that was going on? I still think that would be a potential concern there. But there's so much talent, and there has been development. I think, you know, technically he looks better. I think he has a better grasp, and physically, he's so capable that you understand why they have him in a kind of a higher position and are betting that he's going to turn into a good tackle. So I still think that the arrow is pointing up for Mailata. It's just whether he's kind of ready for it right now. That's a different question.
Tim McManus with us, ESPN.com, ESPN, and of course 97.5 The Fanatic. It's a Football Friday. Brought to you by Rosenbaum Injury Law, the power of justice for accidents, malpractice, or nursing home abuse. Remember Rosenbaum, over two decades helping our community. All right, the story was fascinating because you go over the plight of Carson over the last 2 years, and it's a winding story. And, you know, what makes it really, really interesting was the idea that the second time, he has to endure it early. You write about, and you quote, the back, that he was feeling the back pregame against the Vikings, and that was early October, much earlier than I think most people thought that back thing.
Yeah, that was just his third game back. So if you think about a quarterback that's already dealing with coming off of the multi-ligament knee injury, and as we've seen with quarterbacks and other players, it usually takes more like 18 months until a person is at his kind of full self. Add on that the back crept in a lot earlier than people necessarily thought and was hindering him more than he was letting on. And you know, the first evidence of it was in that October 7th game against the Minnesota Vikings, where he's telling a teammate, like, dude, I can't sit, because of my back. I mean, so that kind of shows you that he was hampered longer than people expected. And if you think about what the long kind of road of rehab requires, and the circumstances in which he was operating, and that was Foles taking over, delivering the city its first ever Super Bowl championship. So he's working, you know, his tail off to get back and kind of reclaim the throne and bring that team back. And then all of a sudden, it's like this unwelcome visitor comes, and, you know, his back starts bothering him early and affected him throughout. There's been, you know, a lot that he's been carrying physically. There's a lot that he's been carrying emotionally. And the fact that he is this kind of guy who wants to have control, to control everything around him so it's right. He had, you know, as I described in the piece, like a white knuckle grip around everything. And then finally, he just decided that he had to let it go, that, you know, he couldn't carry it all on his own, that the way that he was conducting himself was counterproductive. And so he's finally, like, kind of shed all that weight that he felt like he had to carry for that long, and is delegating responsibility, is being freer, is not taking everything so seriously. And so that we've seen kind of a physical and a mental transformation out of the quarterback, you know, basically since that stress fracture was detected in December.
Gargano and Martinez Middays. It's 97.5 The Fanatic.
Tim, when you look at that situation, you know, we know football players, they're tough. And you want to show no weakness. And sometimes you don't communicate exactly how you're feeling, or at least not to the right people. As you alluded to in your story, October 7th was when he said to a teammate that he can't sit because his back was so bad. Did he communicate that to his trainers or the team at that time?
I think that they were aware throughout the process that he was dealing with, some back discomfort. I think it kind of ebbed and flowed early. And they were testing him regularly from my understanding, but it didn't show up until December. And so that's part of what Wentz said to me in our one-on-one at the beginning of training camp was, the fact of they knew that the back was broken and they hid it from me or whatever. He's like, that's not the case. He's like, when they found it, we shut it down. So, I think that the communication was there.
They didn't shut it down, though, because they didn't put him on an IR, and they kept him available in case Foles was maybe faltered. There was still, that hope that he could come back, if I recall.
Right, but also, and that's also addressed in the piece, is that he was, going back to sort of the control thing, trying to find any way to kind of get back on the field. So he was looking, and this is the right thing to do, is to go out and look for second, third opinions, but trying to keep that hope alive. All right, can I get back out there for the end of the regular season? Can I get back out there for the playoffs? And once he had this conversation with his pastor in December, which was part of kind of the unloading process, he recognized that he couldn't to just stop trying to control everything. He let loose. So I think that was part of it, Jason. When they didn't shut him down, I think part of it was because behind the scenes, he was fighting, scratching, searching for any possible way to get back on the field. And they weren't going to just say, no, you're done. They were, they were allowing him to have that process.
We're talking to T-Mac right here. He's live in studio, in fact. The Darren Sproles thing was interesting. So Sproles pulls him aside and kind of gives him a little tough love.
Yep, that's the way that I understand it. That there was a scene in the trainer's room in 2017, shortly after Wentz, had the torn ACL, in which there was what was described as not an adversarial moment, but it was tense to where people kind of looked at it, looked over and checked on them afterwards, is everything cool? And basically, the message that was delivered by Sproles was that listen, lift your chin up, and keep your keep your eyes focused on the task at hand. Of course, they're still in the midst of a run. They were hoping to make something of it. Nick Foles needed to have proper support. Now, Wentz didn't recall that moment, but spoke more generally about the fact that the guys in the training room together, of course, he was with Peters and all these other guys, with Sproles, really helped each other and were this nucleus that were, helping one another and dealing with the feelings that come with not being able to be part of the Super Bowl run. But I think that just kind of highlighted the fact that there have been these ebbs and flows for Wentz. There have been these high points, MVP charge, best team in the league, followed by a hard crash down in which some of his teammates needed to kind of rally him. But the way I understand it, he rallied in a huge way in that 2017 year for Foles. I mean, he wanted to be in that quarterback room so bad that he took the portable modalities and all these different things, compression devices, ice packs, you name it, into the quarterback room so he could do part of his rehab there so he could be right next to Foles.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Great support.
But the real, to me, the tougher part, it's not just all right, well, the hero goes down and then the backup comes on to win the Super Bowl, and that's tough enough. But to me, what happened last year is what really makes this situation extra tough. That's the extra layer that he has to overcome. To have it happen a second time in the second year and Foles rescues the season again. I mean, that's the tough part of the story, the tougher part of the story of even the Super Bowl.
Yeah, and you're in a situation where it's kind of unprecedented. I mean, when he walks through the halls, there's a big, image of Foles staring back at him with the Super Bowl 52 signage. When he goes to the stadium, there's a giant bronze statue of his former backup. And there's all those pressures that come along with the pressures that he already puts on himself. I mean, he's considered a perfectionist. So that's why this offseason was so important for him, is because you can either fight those ghosts, right? You can grit your teeth and you can be swinging at all those things. Now I'm going to overcome it and all that kind of stuff. Or you can just take a deep breath and relax and have some fun and, you know, and treat it like the game that you love. And I think that that's something that he's done where he's, you know, instead of like carrying all that tension that's inside him, all the angst, like he let it out. You know, he's not feeling like he's got to be Superman. And I think that's been a transformation for him that will serve him well coming up this season.
Big, big deal.
Yeah, does he seem liberated, mentally liberated to you in a way, Tim?
Totally.
Wow, that's totally great. That's great news because you said that. I mean, you compound all those things, and that pressure is astounding. And maybe his faith plays a part in that for him. But to hear you say, Tim, that you know, it's noticeable he's liberated. You know, just in the way he carries himself.
I saw it the second that I walked in. So I had a one-on-one with him on the first day of training camp, the day that they reported. I walked in. And he's sitting in the office, and I could just tell from, like, as soon as I see him, you know, the look on his face was something that was like had been missing for like a year and a half. Wow. In a public setting where he just looked at ease, you know, and he looked happy. And of course, he looked different physically from the transformation that he had through his trainers and through his diet. And then the way that you see him interact on the field, it's a lot lighter. He's joking with teammates. He's talking to more teammates. Like he'll go up during warmups and he'll grab like a couple guys at the bottom of the roster on defense and make a point to speak with them in a kind of light fashion for a minute before taking his place in line. You see him having fun with the guys on the sidelines, celebrating afterwards. And there's just something that, like, when you're pressing so hard and you're physically hindered, it's harder to act that way. Plus, add on the whole Nick Foles thing on top of that. It's tough to operate like that. So I think he's a lot healthier in a lot different ways right now.
T-Mac with us. Last thing on the Wentz situation. The type A personality, to me, that's a really difficult thing to kind of put that aside. You are what you are. Like, you're a type A guy. You are, you know, we talk about control freak. How much did that impact the relationship between he and Mike Groh? And, you know, how do you just put that aside? Like, that's a tough thing to step back.
Yeah, and so there was something in the Philly Voice article about the fact that someone perceived Wentz as bullying Groh. I don't think Groh ever perceived it that way or Wentz, you know, intended that way either. I think that it's you have to understand who he is, that he's not a wallflower, that he has opinions, that he is going to go in there and he's going to share them, and there's going to be back and forth, and most coaches welcome that because they recognize that's a sign of like an elite quarterback mind. Yeah. Most of these guys are type A. There's exceptions to rule, like, and Foles was one of them, and that was a nice counterbalance that Wentz has used to his benefit moving forward. I mean, during our conversation, he brought up Foles unprompted. He's like, when I asked him about how he's changed, like, one of the first things he said was, you know, I learned a lot from Nick, he had this, like, laid-back kind of approach where I'm like this kind of, you know, controlling, you know, like type A, and he's just like, you know, the California kid, and he learns something about how you approach the craft, you know, through working with Foles. So I think that's what he's trying to implement. Wow. To your point, Anthony, like he's not going to change to Foles temperamentally.
Right.
But if he adds like a little dose here and there and gains some perspective as you do, as you're in the league for longer, you know, this is year four now, he can take a breath a little bit. I think those things will work to his benefit.
Wow.
T-Mac, great stuff, man. It really is. It's fantastic. I mean, it really is.
I really appreciate that,
job,
guys.
Man.
Thank you.
All right. And Embedded, people, when's the new episode come out?
Well, I'm about to record right now. And then,
just post this.
Yeah, I might just do that. Hey, are we done?
Yeah.
Racket,
baby.
We're looking forward to regular season, Tim, man. Great coverage. We appreciate it.
I can't wait. Thanks, guys.
Wow.
There he is, Tim McManus.
Great stuff.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.